Good afternoon. Welcome once again to Line One, your health connection. I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. We're inching towards health care reform in this country. Many Americans feel it's about time, but we can't seem to agree on how we're going to improve our health care system. Can we learn anything from the health care systems of other countries? Our phone numbers are 550-8422 in Anchorage. Our outside Anchorage number is toll-free, 1-800-478-8255. And our email address is line1@aprn.org. Coming up next hour, we'll examine healthcare in other industrialized nations on Line One, your health connection.
Today's program is underwritten in part by this member station of the Alaska Public Radio Network. Providence, Alaska combines state-of-the-art technology with a team of skilled and experienced physicians and nurses. With locations in Anchorage, Wasilla, Seward, Valdez, and Kodiak, Providence offers needed medical care close to home. For more information, log on to providence.org/Alaska. This message is sponsored by Providence, Alaska Medical Center.
Welcome to Line One, your health connection. I am your host, Dr. Thad Woodard, and today we're going to be comparing healthcare systems with those of other industrialized nations, examine some myths, and look at what's working and not working as we try to reform our healthcare system. Our phone numbers are familiar to you if you listen to APRN's Talk of Alaska. In Anchorage, the number is 550-8422, and our toll-free number 1-800-478-8255. And you can email us as well at line1@aprn.org. My guest today is Dr. Stephen Miles. He's professor of medicine and bioethics at the University of Minnesota Medical School in Minneapolis. He's an affiliate faculty member of the Center for Holocaust and Genocide Studies and for the law school's concentration in health and bioethics. He's a board-certified internal medicine physician and also practices geriatrics. He teaches and practices internal medicine at the University of Minnesota. His work has changed healthcare insurance, end-of-life care, the use of restraints in nursing homes, refugee camp medicine, and prison medical ethics. Before I get started with Dr. Miles, I want to just remind everybody next week our guest will be Dr. Brad Gessner, an epidemiologist with the state of Alaska, and our topic will be one of the more perplexing mysteries in medicine, sudden infant death syndrome. Dr. Miles, welcome to Line One.
It's a pleasure to be on. Thank you for having me.
I was thinking before the program, I'm not sure we've ever had a bioethicist, and maybe a reasonable place to start is tell us what is a bioethicist and what do you do for a living?
Well, what I do for a living is I practice medicine. What I do to teach is, and for my research, is I write on ethics problems or the role of values in medicine, and that includes everything from end-of-life care, which is where I started, to questions of the use of restraints, to the role of doctors in torture and how they can resist participation in torture, to healthcare reform and a variety of other problems. Some of my colleagues work on issues like stem cells, abortion, questions of in vitro fertilization, how do you cue people for organ transplants, and those kinds of issues as well.
Well, you mentioned healthcare reform, and I'm not sure everyone would jump to the association with bioethics. I would. Tell us about how you got specifically interested from an ethical ethical framework in healthcare reform.
Well, I think that when you look at the American healthcare system, one of the things that is striking about it, of course, is that we are the only industrialized country that allows, in our case, now 46 million people to be without insurance. That every other industrial country has said everybody should have health care insurance. And the reason they do that is an ethical statement that basically says nobody should have life opportunities diminished for want of access to a package of health care benefits. That is an ethical statement by those countries. And so you really can't, it's only in the United States where we've said this is a policy question rather than an ethics question.
Does that realization, that fact that we are one of the only industrialized country that has not made that decision to this point to make sure everyone has equal or reasonable access to health care strike you as unusual?
It's not unusual considering our particular circumstance. Mm-hmm. In some ways, it was an accident that other countries established this policy. For Europe, the policy was established at the end of World War II, essentially because of the fact that they bought labor peace by saying, if you won't strike, in the case of England, for example, then what we will do is we will guarantee universal health care. And so that's how the universal mm-hmm. System was built in England. In other countries like Canada, it was really built explicitly as an ethics statement that every citizen must have access to health care. And indeed, there are various UN documents that assert that that's a obligation as well.
I guess what I thought about it, as you said that comment, is that we're probably, and I'm not sure about this fact, but one of the more religious countries in the world, and yet we have not addressed this almost, you know, again, ethical need to make sure our population has good access to a basic need of health care. So I find it, at least in my mind, I jump to the conclusion, well, it just seems a little odd for our country not to have done this.
Well, I think it is odd, but I think, to be fair, there's several different kinds of religion in the United States, and one of them is the American civil religion, which very much says that you should be able to make it on your own. Mm-hmm. And the other real mm-hmm. problem with the United mm-hmm. States, and an area where we're special, is that any system of health care reform or universal health care is necessarily a transfer of wealth from the wealthiest to the poorest. In some ways, we're all temporarily able-bodied. We all get old, and we'll all become disabled. But also, illness itself is generally randomly distributed. Things like multiple sclerosis, we don't have any control over. And we just don't like the idea that you have to somehow find a way to distribute wealth from people who get poor because of illness.
But these illnesses are... I mean, the same thing can be said of an accident, getting hit by a drunk driver, developing
sure.
cancer. I mean, these are not things that people have control over.
No, they don't have control over them. And I think that one of the problems has been that when we came out of World War II, we were so wealthy as a nation mm-hmm. that what we were able to do was to say of a hospital, well, you just take a little bit of money off of the Blue Cross payment to your hospital and cover the uninsured who come into your hospital. But with the decline of unions and with the changes in healthcare financing generally, healthcare became more expensive. That system of voluntary coverage within hospitals fell apart. And the other big thing that happened was that we shifted from hospitals that had were affiliated with religious communities like Lutheran Hospital. And I would imagine Providence sounds like a religious background right. to that hospital as well.
Correct.
To hospitals that are really secular systems in which have operate for the bottom line like corporations. And that, too, has hurt the safety net that was provided within the private sector.
Mm-hmm. All right. So let's get off, at least for the time being, the ethics and morality of this question about why we have so many people uninsured and so difficult to make the change to do that. To why are we now coming to grips with the fact that there seems to be, I guess, a consensus that we need to make some health care reform? What is it that's causing that to happen?
Well, there are two issues. One, and I think this is less important, is the moral claim that we must provide health care for everybody. Although to some extent the degree of pain within the entire population has become really extreme. But the other issue is economic, and there are two parts of this economic issue. First is the fact that if you take a $50,000 car made in Sweden, about $5,000 of that car is their healthcare system. if you take that $50,000 car in the United States, about $8,000 of that car is our health care system. And what that means is that there's a $3,000 invisible part on that car, and that makes our cars non-competitive for selling overseas. Other nations will not pay a $3,000 premium on a $50,000 car for a product they can't see. And the second economic issue is really interesting, and that is that somewhere around 50% of the middle class cannot change jobs because they are afraid of losing their health insurance. And for an entrepreneurial economy like we have, that job lock phenomenon paralyzes the adaptability of our economy.
So there's a huge moral reason that's we're coming to grips with, and then there's this bottom line economic reason that affects both all of us individually, but also as a country.
Absolutely.
And those are things that we've finally are driving us to make some changes in our healthcare system, which is obviously be eating up more and more and more of our gross national product. So at an unsustainable rate, I think everybody would agree with that.
Well, it is, and I think also that we realize that if we want to compete economically, we have to compete as an industrial power. And to compete as an industrial power, we have to solve the healthcare financing problem.
Okay. We have a caller, and I want to go ahead and take Bill's phone call and comments. Bill, you're on line one.
Yeah, thanks. Happy New Year, both of you. Hey, I understand that baseball and healthcare insurance companies fall under the Sherman Antitrust Act, and I was just wondering why.
Well, we've had a unique set of protections for the healthcare system, and most of them relate to the fact that when you get healthcare costing up to, right now it's roughly a seventh of the economy, their lobbying power is virtually invincible. And so we have, for example, made numerous exceptions to healthcare institutions compared to other ones. My personal favorite is we generally have a free trade policy. We say, well, we will not protect our local products with tariffs and so forth, except for drugs, where we say you can't bring drugs from cheaper production facilities overseas and into the United States. And there is also there are other protections as well, and the Sherman Antitrust one is another one that has basically allowed extremely powerful conglomerates to operate in any other field. They'd be regulated utilities, but in the healthcare sector, they're allowed to operate unfettered.
Okay, I have a follow-up question. Right now, I have insurance. However, I want to go see a naturopathic doctor in town here. No offense to any medical doctors. There's a law on the books in the state of Alaska that says that chiropractors and naturopaths will be paid. When my insurance company goes to pay, they say, no, we don't have to because we are based outside of the state of Alaska. So in this new health care bill, apparently you're allowed to buy insurance across state lines. Will that clear up this problem?
That is a really interesting question, and the issue there has to do with what is the benefit set itself going to be in the new healthcare plan. And I think that where we're winding up is that they're going to say that we will take any healthcare benefit that is going to be evidence supported. And so, for example, the use of a chiropractor for low back injuries or is well supported. And in that case, I think that you should be able to get your claim filled under the new system, as I understand it. However, if you want to use your chiropractor to treat a problem like diabetes, you're going to run into a big problem because spinal manipulation has not been shown to be useful for that particular set of treatments.
I agree. Okay, the other thing is I just want to leave you with this thought. What other business, what other entity, do we give the money to the insurance company first and then they pay from there? If you want to buy a car, you go to GM. You know, if you want to go, if you cut yourself, you don't call the insurance company, you go to the hospital.
I think that's a fun question. Some people, one of my favorite lines in an Oscar Wilde play is, how come we pay doctors before we know the outcome of their work?
I think he also said, I can resist anything but temptation. I'll let you guys go. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Bill, thanks for your call. Let me remind our listeners, if you've got comments or questions or need some clarification, call us in Anchorage at 550-8422. Our toll-free number, 1-800-478-8255, and you can email us at line1, it's all one word, L-I-N-E-O-N-E, at aprn.org. So where are we now in this process?
Well, we've got a bill, and actually we've got two bills, one House and one Senate, and we're trying to figure out how we stitch those together to get something that will actually pass. I think we're all agreed that we're going to have reform in what abusive insurance practices, and one that has not been mentioned that is being reformed, and I think this is a big one for your listeners, is in the United States, many insurance packages, for example, for a 28-year-old woman, run about 50 to 60% higher than for a 28-year-old man because a woman gets pregnant and the man doesn't. And the new reform package, besides taking care of pre-existing conditions, also prohibits gender-based health insurance pricing, which is a good thing because the extra premiums that are charged to women, most pregnancies come from reasonably cooperative endeavors between men and women, and furthermore, women earn less than men, and so they wind up being especially discriminatory. And about 80% of single-parent households are headed by women, and so there's a special burden there as well. The new policy will say men and women pay the same.
So it appears that what we're going to get, and you please correct me if I'm wrong, is we're going to get some reform that better is more equitable from a health insurance standpoint in coverage.
Right.
A larger proportion of our population, I've seen 93% is a number thrown around, will be have access now to health care insurance. But I'm not – one of the points you mentioned and what I hear talked about a lot is the economic issues, and I don't – I'm not sure I see that in where we are right now. Am I missing it? Or are we failing to address this huge issue?
Well, I think that's a great question, and here's how I see it. The myth of the health insurance reform that has preceded us, and this was what happened when the Clinton plan went down, was the idea, well, if we just say, let's have cost savings, say with managed competition between HMOs, that somehow insurance access will expand. And in fact, what other countries have found is when you put more people into the pool, that the prices come down. And the current prices in the U.S. healthcare system are completely out of whack. Everybody knows the, you know, $10 mm-hmm. aspirin tablet in the hospital. And so one of the things that we find is that when that comes, when you put more people in, that the pricing's rationalized because the system can't solve its cost problem by dumping patients.
Mm-hmm. All right, and we have a bigger pool, and so everybody it just kind of evens out, and it's in that. So that what you're saying is some of the economic burdens will be modified, we expect, with this system.
Right, and I think another myth here has been that, well, gosh, in order to bring 40 million people into the economy or health insurance pool, that therefore we're going to have to increase government expenditures by a same amount.
Mm-hmm.
One of the absolutely fascinating things to me is that when you look at the U.S. healthcare system, is that the government funding in the United States compared to other countries is actually it's about the same as other countries. That the huge amount of extra spending in the United States has to do with the costs of insurance deductibles and other co-payments. And when you take those out of the equation, that's where all of our extra costs are.
Mm-hmm.
And so once we bring prices under control, I don't expect government expenditures to go up that much.
Another comment, and this may be hard for you to answer, but it's on my mind since our Republican Senator, Lisa Murkowski, was quoted this weekend in an interview with the Anchorage Daily News that she says the Congressional Budget Office has done research suggesting that the cost of health insurance premiums will go up 10 to 13% basically across the board, if I'm quoting her correctly, with this new system. She's obviously one of those who voted against it. And yet, at the same time, I see estimates that we're going to save, hundreds of millions of dollars and maybe as much as $1 trillion over a couple of decades on the bottom line. And so I'm having trouble.
The experience suggests that we're going to save money. There are two possible places where there could be an increase of money coming in, needed. Mm-hmm. One is that when you immediately insure uninsured persons, there's a little bubble of health care expenditures when that happens. States that have introduced health care reforms like CHIP or the subsidized insurance programs for children, for example, have noticed a little blip, but it's generally small. I think the question to ask the critics of healthcare funding is to ask, well, what is your solution mm-hmm. to the rocketing costs of healthcare? People are saying, for example, I heard a guy the other day, a senator, say, well, why are we rushing this thing through? Well, this thing has been on the table since Harry Truman, actually Roosevelt. Right. It's not being rushed through at all. It's just that nobody has taken the bull by the horns and addressed it.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. We have another caller. Chris, you're on line one.
Thank you.
Hi, Chris.
Hi. I'm a federal employee. My husband is a state of Alaska employee, and neither of our insurances cover physical therapy for our son with cerebral palsy. Mm-hmm. They consider it not medically necessary. In other words, he won't die if he doesn't get it.
Right.
He will develop contractures and be in pain and require surgery, which they will pay for. It makes no sense. And so the cost falls through to the state of Alaska. Medicaid program, which sounds okay because if the feds pay 50% of that, but the state of Alaska shouldn't be paying 50% of it. It should be our primary insurances. Is there anything in the legislature that addresses these?
The question of, there's a very complex question that has to do with what's called maintenance services for chronically ill patients. And as a geriatrician, this is an area that's dear to my heart, and I can't read the current reform bill on this question. But it goes like this. They will cover services to cure somebody, but they won't cover services to maintain somebody at a certain level of function. But the problem is that kids like your son will get worse if they don't get therapies to keep them steady. And we need to address this as a nation. We are a nation of increasingly chronically ill. The days when an illness in the United States was an acute illness that then went away, like, appendicitis, are long gone, and we have a creaking healthcare system that is based on the idea that you get treated, you get cured, and then you're out the door. So I don't know what's going to happen, but I sure hope that one gets fixed, because if not, we'll come back and revisit this. And I think that, by the way, that is a very important take-home lesson, that this healthcare reform bill, even though Mr. Obama can't say it, is only step one, and we will be back and adding to it again and again until we get it right.
Thank you for your help.
Thanks for your call, Chris.
Good luck, Chris.
Yep. We've moved away from the primary focus here that we wanted to get to, and that's comparing other countries. So I want to do that, and I want to comment that I have gotten an email that addresses where this program is going. If we have a chance to get to it, I will. But I also want our listeners to know, in 2 weeks, I'll be interviewing Gail Walensky, who is an economist that's been very big in this healthcare movement. She's written several articles. She's been involved with the Medicare legislation and so forth. And I think if I don't get to questions about where this current legislation is going, we will save your emails and get to it in 2 weeks. If we get time, we'll come back to it. Dr. Miles, let's get back to this interest of what's going on. Is it reasonable, let's start off, for us to compare our health care system with other countries?
Sure. Let me compare it three ways. First, the question of costs. The United States currently costs about $7,500 per person per year. All the other developed countries, say from Finland to Switzerland, basically cost $4,000. So it's $4,000 versus $7,500. So our costs are out of control. Number two, our outcomes are poor. Our infant mortality is the highest of all the developed countries. It's about 6.5 per thousand. Other countries sit around 4 per thousand. Our life expectancy is low. Our life expectancy at age 65 is low. And our disability levels are the highest among all the developed countries. So we're paying a lot of money and we're not getting good results. The second, and one of the things that's so discouraging about that, is that every year you hear about how our baby death rate is going down and our life expectancy is going up, which is true, but our improvements in those things are slower than other countries, so we're falling further behind. Number two, do these other countries ration? And you've heard a lot in Alaska about death panels and that kind of thing. And let me just say this, that in terms of doctors, in terms of general physician supply per 1,000 population, we are in the bottom third. In terms of specialist supply, I'm sorry, in the bottom tenth. In terms of specialist supply, we're in the bottom third. In terms of doctor visits, we're in the bottom quarter. In terms of hospital length of stay, we're in the bottom 20%. In terms of, now there are things that we do. For example, we do a lot of coronary bypass grafts and stuff. But our coronary, our heart attack mortality rate is exactly like other countries. We have fewer radiation therapy centers than other countries. We do a few more transplants. How big is, how many people live in Anchorage?
About, let's say 300,000, 260,000, 300,000.
Okay. Compared to a city the same size in Europe, we do about six more kidney transplants a year. But basically, they're doing, we don't, these other systems don't get ahead by rationing. And frankly, it's just weird to think that they would, because if they get better outcomes by rationing, that means that healthcare is a toxic waste product.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Now, the third part of the myth goes like this. Well, if they don't ration, then it's the American consumers to blame. They drink and smoke too much, okay? In fact, we are the least drinking, least smoking industrialized nation on the planet. The smoking levels in the Netherlands are almost twice ours. The French do their Galois, and they drink wine, and they're healthier than us, and they pay less for health care. We're younger than other countries. It's not our greedy geezers. And we are heavier, but the extra weight in the United States is about 2-4% of our extra costs, a very small part of the problem. So the bottom line is we spend a lot of money. We get poor outcomes. We are the ones that ration access to health care. It's primarily price rationing. It's not our consumers who are the problem.
All right. So now we're getting into some significant issues, and it unfortunately is a time for me to take a brief break. We're going to come back and talk about this some more. You're listening to Line 1, your health connection in Anchorage. Call 550-8422. Our toll-free number, 1-800-478-8255, or you can email us at line1@APRN.org. After this break, we'll continue to take your calls and talk with Dr. Steve Miles on Line 1, Your Health Connection. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard.
Line 1, Your Health Connection, comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from the Lake Otis Pharmacy, prescriptions, support hose, medical equipment, and a full selection of satellites in Alaska. The Lake Otis Pharmacy on Lake Otis, one block north of Tudor, with the wheelchair on the sign. And by Providence Imaging Center, providing early detection of breast cancer with digital screening mammography, and technologists with more than 170 years of combined experience. Information at provimaging.com.
Hi, you're listening to Line 1, Your Health Connection. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard. Today we're speaking with Dr. Steve Miles. He's professor of medicine and bioethics at the University of Minnesota Medical School in Minneapolis. We're kind of talking about our current healthcare system and its problems, and hope to really spend a little bit more time comparing our system with those of other developed nations in the next half hour. You can email your questions and comments to line1@APRN.org. You can call us locally at 550-8422. Our toll-free number, 1-800-478-8255. And please remember, if you're listening between 8 and 9 at night, you're listening to a recorded program. So, Dr. Miles, you've done a good job of helping us understand where we are currently. We've talked about some of our problems. We began to introduce the idea that other countries are doing things differently. They're doing it cheaper and with better quality, which we've really talked about on this program before. And you begin to address some of the reasons people might say that that is the case. One that I've heard myself when I've tried to discuss, particularly with physicians, is that, well, wait a minute, we're not really comparing apples and apples with different countries necessarily. The statistics aren't looking at the same thing. And it seems to me you're saying that generally it is. And another issue I bring up is, well, wait a minute, Canada is a pretty similar composition, to us, and is right next to us, and yet they still do it a lot cheaper and with better quality than ourselves. How do you answer those questions?
Well, the way I answer it is I use something that's called the OECD, which is the gold standard for developing statistics that compare different countries. And so what the OECD does is it makes sure that you are comparing apples to apples. That's one answer. The second thing is that it doesn't really matter which statistic you take. It doesn't matter whether you take maternal mortality or life expectancy. It doesn't matter whether you take physician visits per year or length of stay in hospitals. It doesn't matter whether you take survival from cancer or survival from heart attacks. Our statistics simply don't add up. And if it was simply one statistic, I suppose that would be absolutely true. There are lies and damn lies, and then there are statistics. But the fact is that it pretty much applies across the board.
Okay. All right. We have another caller. I think I'm going to go ahead and take Jim. Jim, what can we do for you?
Yes, I can't remember where I read this, but I read recently that the poorest one-fifth of the population in the United Kingdom has gross health statistics roughly equivalent to the richest one-fifth of the population in the United States.
I don't know how
we could, you know, and they're spending a lot of money on health care. Maybe they're shopping too much. Or
well, one of the problems in the generally, it's very hard to compare across income groups, and here's why, and that's why I don't generally do it. The United States has such a broad gap between rich and poor compared to countries like Canada or Europe. And so one of the problems is that since there's a small gap between rich and poor, when you say that the bottom 10% of England versus the top 10% of England, you're talking about a relatively small difference compared to the bottom 10% in the U.S. versus the top 10% in the U.S.
All right. Along the same line is some comments that I've heard a couple of times, because I've interviewed Dr. Stephen Bezruczka of the University of Washington a couple of times, and again recently. And in he brings up some very interesting points, which all you have to do is get on almost any school of public health. You see this repeated a lot, is that he makes a distinguishes population health and health care. And he does that because it turns out that how much you spend in a country on health care has no relationship to the population's health. And we're a perfect example where we spend almost, as you pointed out, twice as much. And yet our health care, economics or how we're doing as a country is lower. And that he brings out that's because we have this huge disparity in income, so that there's a lot of people that are suffering quite a bit. And so overall, our health care doesn't look very good because of that.
Well, I think to some extent that's true. But I think that the problem with that approach is that you can, instead then of looking at the average health care, you can actually look at the disparities themselves. And so then you can, instead of ranking the countries in terms of average life expectancy or average neonatal mortality, you can rank it by disparities. And when you use disparities, what you find is that the United States comes out even worse, that our gap between rich and poor is really extraordinarily unacceptable. For example, I'm in the center of a major city here. It's a nice city, and yet I know that if I go 1 mile from here, that the neonatal death rate is worse than Costa Rica.
All right. Another issue that I think puts some focus on misunderstanding about healthcare in different countries is that, although I haven't heard it a lot recently, it's been a common theme that Americans don't want socialized medicine. I'm not sure that's even on the table. I've never seen that, but that's another one of those maybe misinformations. In other industrialized countries, particularly in Western Europe, let's look at Japan, throw that in there, Taiwan. Are these countries having socialized medicine? Is that how they achieve the gains they have?
Well, socialized medicine is kind of in the eyes of the person who's throwing rocks. But I guess I would put it this way. Socialized medicine could, at one level, refer to a nationalized health insurance system like, say, in England.
Mm-hmm.
It could, in the case of Germany or in the Netherlands, say that the government collects premiums and then disperses them to essentially private utility HMOs. In France, they have a public option, and they also have private insurance companies, and the government ensures that they can compete, and they compete in a stable way. And then Canada has public insurers with private hospitals. And so the question of which is socialist is an open question. In the United States, we have two big socialist systems, excluding the military. One is the VA, and the other one is Medicare. And I've heard relatively few people say that they want to throw out their Medicare system.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and another issue that, particularly with Canada, that I hear about is that when you look at how different countries are rated according to different aspects of healthcare, Canada is very poor in access. And so here in Alaska and northern part of the United States, we hear about people coming down and wanting to get their procedures done a little bit more quickly. Is that real in from what you know? I mean, is it fair to use that example as something we're not doing well?
I think what's so interesting about the waiting time argument is, first off, when you look at the waiting time, and there's a terrific study of this that was done by the Commonwealth Fund, what you see is that, yes, the United States has shorter waiting times. We run generally about 60% of people, 60% getting procedures within a month. Other countries run about 40% getting it within a month. But the way you got to understand that is that if you don't get the procedure, what is your waiting time? And the fact is then you drop out of the analysis. And so, for example, it's true that in the United States, if you need most people say, well, the waiting time to get a hip replaced so I can play golf is short. It's like a week or two. But the fact is that the United States hip replacement rate is half of that of France, half of that of Norway, half of that of Sweden, and about a third less than Finland, Iceland, Denmark, Scotland, Australia, and England. And so even though the waiting time is shorter in the United States, the chance of getting a hip if you need one is much higher in our industrial peers.
What about other myths? Are there other specific issues that you think are helpful for us to understand about how we are different and what that means for our healthcare system?
I think one of the ongoing debates about our healthcare system is the question of what are we doing with end-of-life care? What are we doing with spending huge amounts of money on people who are on the last year of their life? And one of the things that people don't know is that that's about 11% of our total healthcare budget. People get sick when they get old. But the other thing they don't know is that currently around 85% of the deaths in the United States are preceded by decisions to withhold or withdraw life support. This is everything from hospices to do not resuscitate orders to decisions to for grandmother who has a severe Alzheimer's disease to stay in a nursing home rather than go back to a hospital, to a decision to stop treatment on a kid who runs a snowmobile into a bridge abutment. And the fact is that the United States has thoroughly and completely implemented a decision, a national policy, based on personal preference, that withholds life support from people who are in the process of dying.
All right. Let's take another phone call. Marcia, you're on line one.
Yes, can you hear me?
You sure can.
Okay. I've got a concern about, I think it may be parity or equity in terms of access and what the current options look to be and how they maybe are different in other countries. Because if you have a lot of income here and you want to buy a Cadillac, quote-unquote Cadillac program, you can do so.
Right.
But if you have a very limited income, is there anyone saying this is the minimum that you can get, or is it we're going to pay $10 a day when you're in the hospital and that's insurance?
Under the new plan or our current plan?
The new plan.
The new plan will offer a single comprehensive benefit set for everybody that will be somewhat similar to the current benefit set that is in Medicare or Medicaid, and it will not have these inadequate policies. For example, some people buy basically get sick and only get a little sick or else you go bankrupt policies, which are the low payment policies. And other policies say, well, we won't pay anything for your primary care, but we'll give you catastrophic coverage of if you get catastrophically ill. And the problem with those policies is that they wind up discouraging people from getting preventive health care.
Right.
So as I understand, the new policy is going to be one of providing basically a Medicare-equivalent policy.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah.
Another question is, what do they do in other countries?
Other countries provide a comprehensive benefit set that is actually somewhat more extensive than Medicare. The big variation is in drug coverage. And if you look at Germany, for example, they even cover some spa coverage, which is very hard to get in the U.S. policies. But in the the drug coverage is handled by different means in different countries. Some countries, for example, Canada, have very limited outpatient drug coverage, but they do allow competition in the drug industry so that the drug prices in Canada are approximately 25% lower than in the United States. Other countries offer a comprehensive drug benefit.
Excellent. Thank you.
All right. Thanks for your call, Marcia. All right. Another caller. David, you're on line one.
Hello. I'd like to know how much malpractice and malpractice insurance affects the health care costs in the United States, and if the health care bills that are currently going through Congress, if that addresses it in any way.
Yeah, well, thank you for asking that.
Let's also expand that to other countries, you know, most of the industrialized countries. All right.
Yeah. The interesting thing on malpractice costs is that if you take malpractice insurance, court awards, settlements, that is the amount of money you pay so you don't have to go to court, and legal fees, the total amount in the U.S. healthcare system is around 0.5%. Nobody knows what defensive medicine costs, although the best estimates are around 2 to 6%, with most of them being 4%. Now, keep in mind that the U.S. healthcare system costs almost twice as much as other systems, so that actually the malpractice system is very small. If you take malpractice awards per person year in the United States, it's about $16. In Great Britain, it's about $12. In Canada, it's $10. And in Australia, it's $4. So malpractice is a tiny piece of the puzzle, not a big one, and there is some so-called tort reform in this bill. But one of the biggest pieces of malpractice reform in this bill is that right now, if I get injured by a doctor, I have to sue the doctor to get future health care because I'll have a pre-existing condition. And in a system where I know that I will be insured, that piece of the award will drop out. And so that piece of the health insurance, malpractice insurance, hopefully will also decline.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Good question. We appreciate it. I remember reading a New England Journal article, and I'm looking for reassurance that this is correct, and then what you think, is that the biggest driver of cost of healthcare is new technology. I don't recall whether that includes pharmaceuticals or not, but this is an issue not just in the United States but across the world. Is that true? Is that being handled in the new legislation? How do other countries handle this?
Yeah. New technology is adding costs for all countries, and so all countries are susceptible to the same new technology constraints. Here's the difference, though. In the United States, we tend to be early adapters of new technology, or early adopters of new technology, and then we throw it out when it doesn't work. And so, for example, we'll rush to embrace things like there are all sorts of fads. My favorite was the screw monitor, which was screwed into babies' heads when they were being born to monitor their heartbeats. And then we found, to our horror, after we got everybody doing this thing, including my wife, that it increased the number of infections around birth time. And so then we put on the brakes and stopped doing it. And so you wind up with the United States actually adopting technologies and then having to pull them back, whereas other countries introduce them more slowly. A kind of a classic example of this is CT scans and MRIs. We've got more CTs and MRIs than almost any other country for making images. But what's so interesting is the therapy that works, that is providing radiation therapy, which is a therapy as opposed to a diagnostic tool, we actually have fewer radiation centers per population than other countries. So, yes, technology growth is a big issue, and one of the ways that this new bill purports to handle that is by insisting on more evidence-based medicine as new therapies are added to the benefit set.
Okay. Here's an email that addresses the issue of is Medicare acceptable and are people happy with it? And the author of the email has one opinion, and I'm going to end by saying what I have heard. It says, your speaker says that he spoke to a few people who want to get rid of Medicare. I've spoke to relatively few people who are happy with Medicare. Doctors take Medicare because they feel it's a social duty. Patients are forced into it. Once they turn 65, they don't have a choice. I recall reading or at least hearing of a well-done study that looked at all the health care companies and where you get your health care, and that Medicare patients were, as a group, happier than any other group.
Well, Medicare patients are, as a group, happier than other groups, and the reason for that is that their benefits can't be taken away. Mm-hmm. Now, that's not to say that there aren't problems in Medicare. There are. But you don't see any social stampede to get rid of Medicare. And in fact, one of the interesting phenomena of the health care bill, the health care reform bill, has been Medicare groups who are saying, don't let the government mess with my Medicare, which I find an absolutely amazing statement since the government is their Medicare. But, you know, I'm just a cultural observer.
Okay. Here's an email. It says, what will happen to my auto insurance premium cost if there's universal health care plan? So I'm not sure.
Oh, what a great question. That person is really thinking very hard, perhaps too hard. But here's why that's a good question. Part of your medical or part of your auto insurance is the coverage of injuries to other drivers, and to the extent that they their health injuries are largely picked up by a national health insurance, that piece of auto insurance should go down. There'll still be awards for pain, suffering, disability, loss of income, and so forth. But I would expect it to go down. And I think that this is a big thing. When people talk about how much their taxes will go up, which I think will be very minor, if at all, one of the things you have to remember is your health insurance premiums will go down, and that's a very big deal.
Okay. Another issue we've only glanced into is pharmaceutical companies and the cost of pharmaceuticals in this country. And got an email that says pharmaceutical companies charge more in the U.S. because they can, in quotes. Canada has laws limiting how much a pharmaceutical company can charge. Therefore, the U.S. is carrying more than its fair share. And I've heard this before, that other countries limit it so that pharmaceutical companies therefore charge more in ours. That kind of cost shifting, like we know happens in Medicare, for example, the cost of health care gets transferred to others.
One of the things that's fascinating about, first off, pharmacy costs are about, last time I looked, it was around 11% of the total health care budget. But one of the things that's so fascinating is our drug costs are higher. Now, the drug companies claim that they need a lot of money in order to keep the research and development going. But the fascinating thing about our drug company, and here your readers should go to Fortune magazine, which I think is a wonderful place to look. Every May, they publish the statistics on industry profitability. And the profit levels in the drug industry are the second and third highest of all of the industry groups. And of course, profit in an industry is something that takes place after the research and development costs are taken out. You see what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so if you look at the last issue of Fortune magazine this past May, the drug company profit level was around 17%, whereas the average Fortune 500 company was running at about 3%.
Okay. Another email, it quotes you as saying that hip replacement rates are lower in the United States. One, is that an age-corrected rate? That is, other countries may have older age rates and people living longer and hence needing more hip replacements.
It is age-corrected, and the study for your readers who are interested in this is the Annals of Rheumatologic Disease, volume 62, page 222.
Okay. Second question from the same listener. Is there a country with similar income disparities to which we can compare ourselves vis-a-vis health outcomes?
That is a great question, and the answer is there are two countries with similar income disparities are Australia, because of the outback people, and Norway. And interestingly enough, Norway's income disparities are not as large as ours, but still their healthcare costs are at about 11% of gross domestic product, as opposed to ours are about 17%. And their outcomes are much, much better. Now, one of the things that is very important for listeners to understand is that the lower inequality does produce health, okay? It tends to be associated with higher levels of education, lower levels of obesity, lower levels of heart disease, stroke, and lower levels of unhealthy behaviors like smoking. So lower inequality is good, and to the extent that the United States policies have resulted in a high disparity of incomes, they are also part of the problem with our poor health care outcomes.
We've got about 30 seconds. I'm going to apologize not to getting to all the callers and all the questions, some of which will go for in 2 weeks when we get back to this topic. Dr. Miles, before we get done, what would you want to leave our listeners remembering about today's program?
I think the most important thing for us to remember is that of the 20 or so developed countries that have universal health care, they've all done it different ways. Some have nationalized systems, some are single-payer, some are competing regulated HMOs, some are public option with private insurers competing with it. There's no one way to do this. It's not single-payer or bust Canadian style.
Steve, thanks very much for taking the time and having us able to share your expertise and knowledge. We appreciate it.
It's a pleasure. Talk to you later.
Goodbye. Let me remind also everyone that Line 1 will return next week with Dr. Brad Gessner. Dr. Gessner is an epidemiologist with the state of Alaska. Our topic will be sudden infant death syndrome. Pat Yak is vice president of APTI News and Public Media. Kristen Spack engineered today's program. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard. Have a great day.
This program is a production of APRN, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at aprn.org. CD copies are available by calling 550-8400. Stroke is an emergency. Providence, Alaska Medical Center is committed to increasing awareness of the symptoms of stroke. If you or anyone you know has sudden weakness on one side of your body, sudden confusion, trouble speaking or understanding, sudden trouble seeing, walking, or loss of balance, or sudden severe headaches without cause, call 911 and get to the hospital within 1 hour. Information at providence.org/Alaska. This message is sponsored by Providence, Alaska Medical Center.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.